Thanks for joining us. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. There was some violence and turnout was down, but the elections in Afghanistan went forward on schedule yesterday. There are more signs of a thaw with North Korea. The governor of New Mexico played a part in that this week. And Scotland released the man convicted of masterminding the Lockerbie bombing on compassionate grounds. Joining me to discuss these and other international stories of the week, Tom Shanker, Pentagon correspondent for the New York Times. Welcome back.
So nice to be here. Thank you.
Nancy Youssef, Pentagon correspondent for McClatchy Newspapers. Thanks for being with us again, Nancy.
Thanks for having me.
And Brian Winner, foreign editor for USA Today, who is joining the News Roundup for the first time. Welcome, Brian.
Good morning.
We invite our listeners to join our conversation later in this hour. You can call our toll-free number 1-800-433-8850 or send us an email at drshow@wamu.org. Well, I am a last-minute fill-in for Diane today. She caught her heel in the hem of her slacks while dashing across the street yesterday afternoon, and she cracked her pelvis when she fell. She'll be recuperating for the next several weeks. I know we all send our best wishes to her for a speedy recovery, and we hope to see her back soon in this chair. Well, Nancy, would you say that the Afghanistan elections held yesterday were a success?
I think it's too early to say. I mean, they were able to hold the elections. This was the presidential elections. There were 37 candidates running. What was interesting was where the violence happened. It happened primarily in the south and in places where there were fewer coalition and U.S. troops. So far, we're waiting for the results to come back. We think preliminary results will come back Saturday, and the results won't be certified until September. But I think the U.S. sort of achieved its goal, and the Afghans achieved the goal of holding the elections. But it appears that voter turnout was low, and that this didn't sort of galvanize voters as I think the Americans were hoping when this process began earlier this year.
Now, Tom, the low turnout, could that affect who ends up winning?
Probably not. I mean, I think everyone suspects that Hamid Karzai, the current president, had the fix already in. He's brought back a number of warlords as his allies, and he's done some real sort of politicking to reach out. And I think, as Nancy said so correctly, here in the United States, we always want an election to be a cathartic event, to be a turning point. I don't think this one really is. And I think, you know, if Karzai is elected, his government will move forward with all of its corruption. And the insurgency, too, can show that it can, you know, it kept voter turnout down by threatening violence. There's all these other effects people don't even talk about. The Taliban now threatens cell phone operators across the South, telling them to turn off all cell phone service between 7 p.m. and 7 a.m. Otherwise, the towers will be attacked. That lets the insurgency operate really without any observation or control, and elections just can't change things like that.
Now, we're waiting for a report by the new commander, new U.S. commander in Afghanistan, Brian, and we want to see whether he'll call for more troops, more U.S. troops. If so, how many more troops? What do we think is happening there?
As far as the request for more troops goes?
Yes.
I mean, it does seem there have been preliminary indications that they will ask for more troops over the next few months. What I think remains to be seen is whether the political situation here in the U.S. will allow that, because we see polls right now, support for the war in Afghanistan is dropping to an all-time low.
To what degree, Nancy, does the declining U.S. support for the war in Afghanistan affect how the administration will proceed?
I think it's important that Washington Post and ABC News released a poll this week that found for the first time that a majority of Americans, 51%, do no longer believe this war is worth fighting. At a time when the Obama administration may be asking for more troops, it's certainly asking for more civilian support on the State Department side, and potentially could ask for more money. The strategy that McChrystal has outlined so far, General McChrystal's outlined so far, at the end of the day, calls for a substantial increase in the number of Afghan security forces in a country that cannot pay for them. At the minimum, the Obama administration so far is asking for the United States to commit itself indefinitely to fund those forces. Afghanistan generates about $800 million a year in total revenue, and the minimum cost for sustaining the Afghan security forces is $3 billion a year. And so in this climate, I think it'll be difficult as more and more Americans are seeing higher casualties, are hearing more bad news, and I think they're also hearing how difficult this war is, even relative to Iraq. And ultimately, I think the ultimate problem that they're facing is the Obama administration is arguing that the United States needs to be in Afghanistan to take on al-Qaeda, even as most concede al-Qaeda is in Pakistan. And so I think it's having a hard time reconciling that.
And yet President Obama, as a candidate, Tom, talked about Afghanistan as the right war, the war we had to fight. Could he then turn around now and say, well, things aren't going so well, it's very expensive, the American people don't support it, let's leave or let's withdraw some of our troops?
I mean, the president really has adopted Afghanistan as his war. Remember, it was the righteous conflict after 9/11. The attacks on the United States came from Afghanistan. And I think, as always, there's a clock on the battlefield and there's a clock back here in Washington. The Obama administration, the president himself, the vice president, Secretary of Defense Gates, have really set the clock here at 12 months, 12 to 18 months. So I think the administration will sustain its current policy at least for a year or 18 months, even if it is a test of their leadership.
You know, Brian, we also had a lot of violence this week in Iraq. What happened there?
Well, you saw two coordinated bombings and then a wave of minor attacks elsewhere in Baghdad on the same day. I think the latest death toll from that is at least 100. The reaction by the Iraqi government has been interesting, though. I mean, I think in some respects they're acting almost like a young state should in these situations, because you hear talk from the politicians about accountability of the security forces, and apparently they've arrested some people for negligence. There's been a lot of kind of a rush to judgment saying, well, maybe the Iraqis aren't able to provide security on their own. But the fact is, this all happened 6 weeks after the handover of control by U.S. troops. And then you see this really the first major attack in Baghdad during that time. So I think it'll be interesting to see over the next couple of weeks whether you see similar attacks like this or whether they manage to clamp down and bring things under control a little bit.
Tom, in your paper this morning, the New York Times, there was a front page story that said that the Iraqi government actually had asked for the help of U.S. troops, although they waited a couple hours after the attacks, and then tried to minimize or avoid acknowledging that they had done that. Why?
Well, so much of it is about the optics. The administration of Prime Minister Maliki has said that they're ready to take on security. They are a sovereign state. But within 3 hours of these horrific attacks that Brian just described, they did have to reach out to the American military that, as we all recall, has withdrawn outside the major cities. They needed the support. I think that there are some really important tactical decisions facing Maliki right now. He has embarked on a program to pull down these giant concrete walls. All of us on this panel spent lots of time in Baghdad, and they are ugly and they divide the city, yet they are very important to security. That is one step that he could change. He could stop the removal of those walls, and that could increase security dramatically.
Why do the walls, these concrete walls, barriers, increase security?
Because they allow you to separate neighborhoods. They allow you to have rather impregnable checkpoints so that you can see what vehicles are coming and going. At the same time, it is an overt and ugly sign that Maliki is really not in control of his country, and he wants to remove those visual reminders of the occupation.
But, Nancy, are we seeing growing tensions, rift between the Sunnis and the Shiites there?
Well, I think what we're seeing is an insurgency that's evolving in part because of those walls coming down. The foreign ministry, which was attacked, the bomb went off at a place where there was a checkpoint just a few weeks ago. And it's hard for me to answer that question only in so much as, you know, when the walls were up, the attacks were a lot more indiscriminate. The attackers would go to crowded markets where there was Shia because they couldn't get anywhere else. And now, with so many walls coming down so quickly, this time they went after political headquarters. So I'm not sure if it's an evolution of the Shia-Sunni rift or if it's an anti-government versus pro-insurgency rift. I don't know how sectarian it is, because the dismantling of those walls gave the insurgency a lot more opportunity to have more precise attacks.
Our phone lines are open. You can give us a call at 1-800-433-8850. Brian.
Yeah, we knew this would happen, though, right? I mean, both Iraqi commanders and American commanders had been warning about this kind of attack pretty much, well, really since early June, when the pullout of U.S. troops from the cities started to happen. And as far as your question, Susan, about Sunni-Shiite rift, I'm not sure it's any worse than it was a couple of months ago. There are apparently some political tensions right now as they try to, undergo this exercise of democracy, getting their coalitions together prior to the elections in January. But things overall seem you know, certainly much better than they were a year and a half ago.
Nancy?
I think it might also speak to a Iraqi security force that is not capable yet of taking over the city as much as people had thought when this began. Is this a test of what they can handle? Is this a sign that the Iraqi troops aren't ready? I mean, how such huge explosives could penetrate so many checkpoints is a problem. And as Brian points out, with everything that happens in Iraq now is always politically motivated, and as were the taking down those blasts walls. And I think one of the reasons that government was so hesitant to ask for U.S. troops is it's the one sign, the ultimate sign, that the Iraqis are not in control if they have to ask U.S. forces to come back into the cities.
Tom, does this violence imperil the schedule that was set up for the withdrawal of most U.S. combat troops?
Well, I mean, the schedule can be altered at the request of the Iraqi administration, but it is a treaty. I mean, it is a bilateral agreement, so it can't be changed on its own. I think one very interesting point for those who are grasping for glimmers of optimism is that the Shia have thus far not really responded with the kind of violence we saw back in 06 that truly drove the country towards civil war. So I think that the Shiite leadership is looking at their numbers, looking at the future, and thus far, according to American intelligence and our colleagues on the ground in Iraq, they are being very restrained. If that restraint holds, then they may actually sort of get through this with a level of violence unacceptable to us, but somehow manageable there.
Tom Shanker is Pentagon correspondent for the New York Times, and we're also joined this hour by Nancy Youssef, Pentagon correspondent for McClatchy Newspapers, and Brian Winter, the foreign editor for USA Today. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll go to the phones. Our toll-free number, 1-800-433-8850, or you can send us an email at drshow@wamu.org. When we come back, we'll talk about the release of the Lockerbie bomber. Stay with us. Welcome back. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. It's our International News Hour, this week with Nancy Youssef from McClatchy, Tom Shanker from the New York Times, and Brian Winter from USA Today. Well, we have an email from John. He writes us from Lake Worth, Florida, and here's what he says. What is the real reason that the Flight 103 bomber was released in Scotland? The 270 people on board were never able to go home. This guy gets to go home to Libya, a former enemy nation, is given a hero's welcome, and gets to spend his final days with his family. Tom, why was the only person convicted of the Lockerbie bomber allowed to go free this week?
Right. The English and Scottish legal tradition have a concept called compassionate release, and it's for those who are in jail as they are truly determined to be close to their deathbed. This man is dying from cancer. Doctors say he has no more than 3 months to live, and the Scottish Minister of Justice decided that under the law of compassionate release, he could go home.
Brian, what was the reaction of the United States government to this plan?
I think Obama definitely came out yesterday forcefully against it, obviously, as I think a large percentage of Americans have a difficult time understanding how this happened. I think it's clear that the Scottish definition of compassion is quite different from the American one. What's less clear is how energetically they were lobbying against this in the days prior to his release. We heard a lot from President Obama on the topic yesterday, but some of the families were complaining yesterday about the administration not advocating as energetically as they would have liked against the release of this man.
Now, Nancy, would that have been because of the desire to improve U.S.-Libyan relations, or why wouldn't the United States government be more adamant in opposing his release?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think that's part of it. And I think, as Tom pointed out, that this was going to be decided by the British judicial system, that this wasn't something that the U.S. could intervene. And the judge in the matter said that he had decided this independent of any outside factors. And in Libya, this was something that was really pushed for by its leadership there. The Libyans see Mr. El-Maghri as someone who was a scapegoat for their country to be treated as pariahs by the West. And I think all those sort of tensions came into play.
Dan from Syracuse, New York, has called us saying there was a lack of evidence in the bombing and it was a miscarriage of justice. Tom, do others feel that way, that perhaps he was wrongly convicted?
There were some interesting interviews this morning, in fact, broadcast by this exact station, saying that even some of those in Scotland thought he was just a scapegoat. The evidence didn't prove the point. That's certainly the view of the Libyan government. I was really touched very, very deeply by an interview with one of the family members of a victim of the Lockerbie crash, who really accepted this by saying, you know, the rule of law is important, and this is the law of the land. If we don't like it, we should try to repeal the law or amend it and have a terrorist exemption to compassionate release. But we don't get to pick and choose what laws we follow and which we don't. That way is the chaos the terrorists want to foment through their violent acts. And again, I don't want to provoke a lot of angry emails, but if we want laws to assure stability, then we have to accept the laws or work to change them and not complain about this one.
Brian, are there any repercussions likely in either U.S.-Libyan relations or even in U.S.-Scottish relations as a result?
I'm not so sure about the U.S.-Scottish. It does seem likely, particularly given Obama's very public warning yesterday that, hey, if this guy is welcomed like a hero in Libya, we're not going to be as cool as we were before, which, by the way, was not that cool to begin with. I mean, part of what's happening here is there's this long-running discussion over how we relate with Libya. It's a country that obviously had a very long tradition of state-sponsored terror and that started to come in from the cold a little bit after 9/11. And now this happens where, you know, you have hundreds of people at the airport waiting to greet this guy, which is the exact opposite image that the Obama administration wanted to see. It's difficult to see how they can now follow that with some sort of warmer ties.
But the Obama administration or any American government has to be very, very careful. This was a, you know, credible, legitimate government exercising laws on its sovereign territory. Think about all the criticism of American policy during the last 8 years in the global war on terror that the Bush administration and now the Obama administration has to deal with, but they defend it as sovereign American decisions. The U.S. government can only push so far on this.
Kim Dae-jung died this week. He was a South Korean leader. He traveled to North Korea for that landmark summit meeting in 2000. And Nancy, his death was an occasion for some signs of warming, or at least a thaw in the very chilly relations between North and South Korea.
That's right. It was one of many that we've seen in recent weeks. One could argue beginning with the release of two American journalists a few weeks ago. This week, a North Korean delegation from the UN met with New Mexico Governor Bill Richardson, and who was also a former UN ambassador, and started to signal that they wanted to thaw relations between the two countries. They pushed for bilateral meetings direct with the United States instead of the six-party talks. The interesting question is this a change of heart by the North Koreans or a need for money? And I think that's what we need to figure out in the days ahead, because they're in such economic turmoil right now. This also comes at a time as the dear leader is sick and there's real questions in North Korea about the line of succession.
Although it was interesting, John Podesta, who was one of the Americans who went with Bill Clinton to bring those American journalists out of North Korea, said at a breakfast with reporters this week that Kim Jong-il seemed pretty with it, looked pretty healthy, was fully engaged in their talks. I thought that was a window that's a little different from what we've heard.
Well, it's just yet another lesson that in the world's most closed country, we just don't know what's going on. The other observation that the Clinton team brought back was that the two aides sitting right next to the dear leader were people that the U.S. government was convinced had been ousted and retired as part of this transition. But here they were at the leader's elbow, clearly still in power. So, Susan, we don't know what's going on.
It's really like when we used to examine, not we ourselves, but when American officials used to examine photos from the Kremlin to see who was in and who was out of in Soviet leadership. Well, let's take a call from our listeners. We'll go first to Tommy. He's calling us from Sanford, North Carolina. Tommy, you're on the air.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you. Hey, I was calling about the Obama and still in Afghanistan because he really, you know, ran on his platform that he was going to try to get us out of all the war. And I didn't vote for him, but I'll tell you, I think he's doing a good job. I'm glad he's in. But as far as the media covering his news conferences and the war, the American people, and speaking for myself, I'm educated mostly by the media. Because once he does a news conference and I sit there and watch him, y'all talk 2 hours to explain what he's saying. So, I mean, the way the media is running the education of the people in the war, I think, you know, I don't understand why y'all complain so much about the war. But I'm not pro-war. I'd love for him to get out.
Now, why do you think he's doing a pretty good job on Afghanistan?
Because in an unusual way, which I was shocked, is he's taking George Bush's same stand. He's totally for getting out, he is. But now that he's in it, he believes in we ought to be there. He's got a drive about staying there and finishing a job or doing what we need to do. And that's one thing I liked about George Bush. I don't agree with everything he did, but he believed in the war. He wasn't there just to get rich and make money like a lot of people complain. But, I mean, he believed in what he's saying. I get that impression strong.
All right, Tommy, thank you so much for your call. You know, one of the complications for President Obama at this point is that Republican voters tend to agree with him on Afghanistan, but his own Democrats, a majority of them, tend to disagree with him.
And I think he'll get a pass from them on, you know, real hard and fast issues for the next, what, year at least, until the midterms maybe starts placing some pressure on him as far as his war policy goes.
It's interesting you say that, too, because one of the reasons some argue that President Obama's push for the war was during the campaign, his base, his voters, wanted to go in Afghanistan. They felt that Iraq was the unjust war and that the United States' effort needed to move to Afghanistan. So it's interesting, just 8 months into his administration, we're already starting to see a shift in terms of where his support is coming from.
Although we've also seen with the buildup of U.S. forces in Afghanistan and them taking a somewhat different tact, rising U.S. casualty rates, and that's of concern to a lot of Americans, Tom.
It certainly is, and that's why the Obama administration right now is writing a set of measurements or metrics for progress in Afghanistan, and it's not going to be number of enemy killed, but the number of locals who participate in government and the economy, and they want to be able to present those both to Democrats in Congress and the American people to sustain this effort and enlarged military deployments.
All right, let's go to Saeed. He's calling us from Fairfax County, Virginia. Saeed, thanks for holding on. Saeed, are you there? I'm afraid we must have lost Saeed. Let's go instead to Matthew. He's calling us from San Antonio, Texas. Matthew, you're on the air.
Hello. As a student of political science and public administration, this part of Afghanistan and Pakistan war is real important to us right now, and I'm not politically affiliated, but I know that this war is important because I know Pakistan is one of the most harshly oppressive and violent Muslim states in the world. They harbor a nuclear scientist that sells nuclear secrets to unauthorized countries and has done it for many decades. They kill their presidents that are running for election. It is if we are running a war on terror, that is definitely someplace we need to be. And while they preach that they believe in Western ideals and support them and believe in fairness and rooting out terrorism, they still support all these networks, and these are the networks that are in power there. And so, really, Afghanistan is important because of Pakistan.
All right, Matthew, thanks for your call. You know, it's certainly true, Nancy, that when you talk to administration officials, they routinely identify Pakistan as the most dangerous place on the globe.
That's right. I mean, when the president came in, they immediately started calling this the AFPAC strategy and linking the two together. And Matthew really gets at the heart of the problem. But it's not as easy as going into Pakistan. There are a lot of diplomatic and considerations that come into play, and I think this is the heart of the problem that the Obama administration is ultimately facing. If the problem is in Pakistan, why is the United States in Afghanistan? Now, the U.S. military would argue that they don't want Afghanistan to become a safe haven for terrorists again, that they don't want people coming back up into Pakistan and using it as a place to plan attacks. But whether the American public will stay with the administration on this, particularly as they see casualties rising, remains to be seen. Remember last month that U.S. casualties at 74 were highest proportionally to the number of troops there than even at the height of the surge in Iraq.
Here's an email from Joseph, who writes us from Nashville. He says, I am a strong and ardent supporter of President Obama, who believes he is doing all the right things, except his position on Afghanistan. We can no longer pretend that the war in that country is a war of necessity. It ceased to be that when President Bush decided to go to Iraq instead of in Afghanistan. The Taliban is a group of entities different from al-Qaeda, who we cannot defeat as much as we cannot install a Western-style democracy in Afghanistan. I am a naturalized American citizen who loves this country. In my native Liberia, we have a saying, little shame is better than a big shame. And I wonder how much Joseph's comments reflect other supporters of President Obama who are concerned about what's happening. Tom?
Well, I think there's a real debate going on as to describe what is the threat. And the Obama strategy did talk about, you know, defeating and deterring al-Qaeda, which has global reach. It's proven that. The Taliban, your correspondent's completely correct, has no global reach. But to the extent that the Taliban destabilize Afghanistan and create a vacuum into which al-Qaeda could again operate, either in Afghanistan or the Pakistan tribal regions, then you can argue it could be an existential threat to the U.S.
Brian?
I mean, at a very basic level, it's been nearly 8 years now since 9/11. And we have this war in Afghanistan where it sometimes seems like Groundhog Day and we keep hearing about the same issues over and over again. And it's like we're just getting started every time. And so I think that comments like that reflect a certain fatigue that's settling in. And our commanders in Afghanistan talk about time horizons in Afghanistan of 10, 20, 30 years, and these comments that Afghanistan is important because of Pakistan, but originally we heard that Pakistan was important because of Afghanistan. It goes on and on.
And, you know, for the Afghan people, I just got back from Afghanistan earlier this month. It's been 8 years for them as well, and there's a real jaded view there about what the coalition forces can do, indeed what the central government can do. We talk a lot today about how violence affected how people made the decision whether to vote or not, but I also think that there's a real exhaustion there, and people aren't thinking about what the central government can do for them anymore. They're thinking of how to survive and manipulate district politics.
I'm Susan Page, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. We're taking your calls at 1-800-433-8850. Well, Nancy, you're just back from Afghanistan. You've made repeated trips there. How were things different this time?
You know, this was the first time that I really felt the Afghan clock ticking among the Afghan people. You know, Tom mentioned earlier the Washington clock, and he's right, it's 12 to 18 months. That's what we keep hearing in this town. But in Afghanistan, that clock is ticking a lot faster. There is not a lot of optimism about what these coalition forces can do. There's not a lot of optimism about what Hamid Karzai could do. And you get the sense that people are just trying to figure out how to manipulate the Taliban or the local district leaders in such a way to survive. The other thing you get is a real change of tenor within the ISAF or NATO forces themselves, with General McChrystal's promotion to the command post there. There's a lot of enthusiasm and buzzing. You see a lot of bright minds coming in and trying to figure out a way of how to make this work. It feels sort of like a Hail Mary pass. They're just throwing everything they can to try to salvage this because they understand the implications of leaving an unstable Afghanistan behind.
I mean, I think the point that Nancy just touched on is the critical one, which truly will be the tipping point between success and failure in Afghanistan. As Brian said, we've been there for 8 years, but really we've been there 1 year at a time, eight times. What McChrystal is doing for the first time, he is setting in a team that will devote the next 3 or 4 or 5 years of their career to this war effort. It's going to be a sustained offensive, and it's going to develop the expertise to see it through. That could actually be a dramatic difference.
I think it's important to remind ourselves, too, that as recently as summer of 2007, Iraq seemed hopeless. And a lot of these same things were being said about Iraq. And now we see a strategy that in some ways, of course, is similar to the one that the U.S. military used in Iraq.
Of course, President Bush defied public opinion in the United States to do the surge in Iraq, which contributed, one of several factors that contributed to the turnaround there.
Well, and one of the things that's going to be really interesting to watch now politically over the next 6 months or so in Afghanistan is this notion that there are going to be negotiations with the Taliban. This is something that the opposition candidates have been advocating, and that I've gotten the impression that Karzai has kind of embraced that as his own cause, in large part because the opposition candidates pushed it. And by contrast with Iraq, by the way, it may be easier to talk to, quote-unquote, the enemy in Afghanistan than it was in Iraq, because whereas in Iraq you had, you know, the al-Qaeda in Iraq, kind of these nihilist insurgents who never really had much of a public face. The difference with the Taliban is that this is a organized group that used to be the government. And so there are people who you can go to. There are things that they want other than just to sow mayhem. So it'll be really interesting to see whoever ends up winning this election, what they do.
Nancy, just briefly, you mentioned the special envoy to Afghanistan and Pakistan that was named by the Obama administration, Ambassador Richard Holbrooke. Do we have a sense of how he's doing?
Well, he was just there, and he called the elections a success. It's a great question. We hear about his presence in these policies, but what he's doing, I think he's sort of, from what we can tell, shaping the discussion and pushing for Afghanistan remaining the priority. As Tom mentioned, this is President Obama's war, but even so, there still needs to be a push for resources and troops and money and going there, and a sort of, as you'll hear in Washington, a whole-of-government approach towards the Afghanistan problem.
Nancy Youssef with McClatchy Newspapers. We're going to take another very short break. When we come back, we'll discuss the meetings held this week between President Obama and President Mubarak of Egypt here in Washington, and we'll go back to the phones and take your calls and read your emails. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by Frederica and Howard Stevenson, helping low-income students access education through the Summer Search Foundation at summersearch.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And by Judy and Steve Hopkins, supporting the Shakespeare Theater Company's The Taming of the Shrew, August 27th through September 12th at Sidney Harmon Hall, Washington, D.C. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we remember TV producer Don Hewitt, the creator of 60 Minutes. He died of cancer Wednesday at the age of 86. Our TV critic David Bianculli will have an appreciation and will listen back to an interview with Hewitt. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Welcome back. We have an email from Mooresville, North Carolina, about the Lockerbie bomber. This person writes, "As someone who lost beloved friends on Pan Am 103, I have to say that I applaud the message President Obama sent to the Libyan government. I would like to see a similar message sent to the government of Scotland. I think many of us would like to write. I would like to know if there's an email or other address for the Scottish judge who so nobly didn't want to discomfort a terrorist in his final days. I think many of us would like to write to him to let our feelings be known." And here's an email from Joan asking about Afghanistan. She writes, "Would you please discuss why we are not enlisting the help of the world community in our efforts in Afghanistan? Why aren't we seeing more international support for the effort in Afghanistan, Nancy?"
Well, the truth is, we did. There were more than 40 countries sending troops to Afghanistan over the last 8 years. But as Tom astutely pointed out, it was never fought year to year to year. It was always 8 individual years. And I embedded with the Canadian forces in Kandahar during this last trip, and you can really feel the exhaustion not only among their troops but among their publics, who feel like they have sacrificed a lot in terms of time and treasure and haven't been sort of given the gratitude, if you want, from the United States, and also haven't seen the results in Afghanistan. In Kandahar, for example, one of the most important areas in Afghanistan, there are 2,800 soldiers there from Canada. About 700 actually go outside. They've lost 125 troops. And you ask the Canadian public, and they haven't seen a return on that investment. They see their military holding on to dear life to just keep the situation tenable such that the Taliban is not able to attack Kandahar.
Joan asked if Hillary Clinton and the special envoys are now actively trying to get more help from the world community. Is that still going on, Tom?
What they've done, the Obama administration has made a clear decision that they're just not going to get any more combat power from either NATO or the other allies. And what they want is civilian support, reconstruction, and most of all, money. As Nancy mentioned so astutely earlier, training the Afghan security forces, that's the only solution. It's a multi-year project, and I know there's a very quiet effort underway, especially in the Persian Gulf oil states, to have them pay for that effort.
Brian, there were meetings in Washington this week between President Obama and President Mubarak of Egypt. It didn't get that much attention here in the United States, but it was a big story in Egypt. What did they talk about?
They basically talked a little bit about trying to move the ball forward on Mideast peace. I think it didn't get a lot of attention because other things were happening this week between the Afghan elections, the attack in Iraq, and a lot of the other things we've discussed on this show today. And also, I mean, frankly, it's a time where it's a little bit difficult to see how the Mideast peace process can move forward in any meaningful way right now.
Now, they did talk, Nancy, about this issue of Israeli settlements.
That's right. President Mubarak said, we need the Israelis to free settlements before the Palestinians can move forward. It was sort of they have to do it first, which is sort of the history of this conflict. They have to do something first, and then we'll do something. So we heard that again. I thought what was interesting, by the way, in these meetings is there was a change in tone from the Bush administration. I think one of the reasons this got such big attention in Egypt is President Mubarak hadn't been in the United States for 5 years, and this was a man who, in previous administrations, was a regular visitor here. Under the Bush administration, the United States said it's not going to forgive or turn a blind eye to the human rights abuses that are alleged in Egypt. And the Obama administration has said essentially that it would temper its criticisms of Egypt in return for its participation in the Israeli-Palestinian talks.
Well, Tom, was that alarming at all to people in Israel or to the Israeli government?
Well, of course, they have a very strong lobby, very active here in the U.S., and they very much like when the U.S. sees the Middle East peace process as the good guys and the bad guys. I think we'd all agree that there's no solution in such a binary approach to such a complicated issue.
Let's talk to Michael. He's calling us from Kalamazoo, Michigan. Michael, thanks for calling.
Thank you for having me on. I have a comment and a question. First, my question. What exactly is our goal in Iraq, Afghanistan, all of them combined? I've served over there for a year. Now, our goal originally was to combat 9/11 style terrorist attacks here in the States. We ended up garrisoning a whole country. Now, if we're going to go in there and put the big footprint down and rebuild everything, it's going to take a lot of people to do it. You can't just go in there with 2,800 people and expect to control something on the size of the state of Texas with over 30 million.
Now, Michael, you said you had served there. In what capacity did you serve?
I'm in the Michigan National Guard. I was in Iraq and Tikrit from 06 through 07.
All right. Well, Michael, thank you so much for your service. And thank you also for your call. Tom.
Well, we all can revisit the history of what the Bush administration argued for the reason to go into Iraq. It turned out not to be true. There were no weapons of mass destruction. The links between Saddam Hussein and Osama bin Laden are thin or non-existent. I think one way of thinking about it is we created a situation there where we then had to battle terrorists and build up a new government. I think in Afghanistan and Pakistan, we are battling terrorism at a much more strategic level that could present a much larger threat to United States security.
Nancy, you're nodding.
Yes, because I think Tom brings up a good point, and I think Michael asks a very smart question, because in both Iraq and Afghanistan, the theory was if you build a stable state, then it won't be a place for terrorism. But the truth is, al-Qaeda has evolved since 2001, and it doesn't need a state anymore the way it did. That is, the next attack could come from Europe, from Somalia, from Yemen. And I think what Michael's ultimately asking, are we fighting the last war, or should we be fighting the next one?
Brian.
Yeah, it does seem as if there's been some mission creep even over the last couple months in Afghanistan. It seems we've reverted back to a classic nation-building exercise, which we originally said we would not get into there. On the other hand, in Iraq, it does seem we're closer to a objective that nobody really likes to say out loud, but that is a moderately troubled state that is a nominal democracy where it is difficult for terrorist groups to operate. And close enough at this point. It seems like we're getting there.
Let's talk to John. He's calling from Miami, and he's held on for quite a while. John, thanks for holding on.
Oh, thanks for having me on. Thanks for the show. I just had a quick, I guess, comment, too. You know, when a person, the president of the United States or any leader of any organization is in place, they have a lot more information than anyone else, including people working for them in their position or us in the public. And a lot of times in elections, not just this past one, you'll hear a lot of candidates who are going for a position say a lot of things about the person in power or in position now. And I'm just curious, has there been any indication that, you know, now that President Obama has been with us for, you know, 6 or 7 months now, is he finding and indicating that he's found a lot of things that he maybe didn't realize were quite the way they were until he actually got the big chair?
An interesting question, John. Brian, what do you think?
Well, it does seem that all presidents shift gears when they do get into office, and President Obama was quite open when he first took office after he met with Petraeus and the other generals for Iraq and Afghanistan. He said, they've essentially asked me for more time. And that is why we continue to have a very high U.S. troop presence in Iraq, for one thing. I mean, I'm not sure a lot of people realize how high troop levels continue to be. I think a lot of people think that we're pulling out. As a matter of fact, troop levels have been almost entirely steady and will continue to be so until the elections in January. We've got about 130,000 troops there still, and then you'll see a broad pullout starting in January next year. And, of course, there is talk of sending even more troops beyond the 21,000 that President Obama has already committed to Afghanistan this year.
And there's a case study that really proves your question, which is the Predator strikes in Pakistan. They had been soundly criticized by Democrats and liberals as attacks on a sovereign country. Why are we doing this? Funny thing, Senator Obama becomes President Obama, and those Predator attacks, if anything, have been accelerated and have become even more effective. So he must have learned something in those early classified briefs.
Nancy, we saw Senator Jim Webb, who's a Democratic senator from Virginia, fly to Myanmar this week to secure the release of an American who'd been sentenced to 7 years in prison. Who was the man whose release he was seeking?
His name is John Yeddo. He's a 54-year-old American veteran from Missouri. And it's sort of bizarre circumstances in which he got arrested. He used homemade flippers to swim across and try to rescue an American or a Democratic icon there, and spent 2 days at her house. And it turned into quite an interesting incident. And so Senator Webb was the first U.S. official to visit Myanmar in more than a decade. And he went and had an interesting visit, because not only did he meet a woman who's been under house arrest for 14 in the last 20 years, he also met with the military leaders there, the junta there, and even Ban Ki-moon wasn't allowed to meet the opposition leader there. And so it was our first sort of introduction into Myanmar. Senator Webb has been a real big proponent of pushing for a more sophisticated approach to Myanmar. Even Hillary Clinton has acknowledged that perhaps economic sanctions have not clamped down the junta, which is accused of making huge human rights violations. The problem with all this is, because of the fact that Mr. Yeddo was allowed into her compound, Burmese government added 18 months to her sentence, which makes her ineligible potentially to run in the 2010 elections.
Brian?
I do think it's brilliant the way the Obama administration has been covertly sending Americans into these rogue countries as a way of getting a foot in the door diplomatically.
Covertly sending them,
I'm joking, yes. Of course. But the parallels with the situation in North Korea, where that kind of gave us a foot in the door as far as diplomacy goes there, then Burma, and of course we have these three quote-unquote backpackers in Iran, which, you know, who knows who we'll be sending over there. Maybe it'll be Jimmy Carter or somebody like that. But what remains to be seen with this is whether it was just an incident of, you know, sending in a high-level guy, Senator Webb, to meet with these guys, securing the release of Yeddah, or whether there is some greater diplomatic meaning to it. I mean, the same is true of North Korea. It is possible that this was just a propaganda opportunity for the North Korean government, and everything that we've said in the media over the last couple of weeks about this potential thaw in diplomacy, we may be overanalyzing it a little bit, because who really knows what those guys are thinking?
You know, Tom, there is a conflict going on, an armed conflict between the Myanmar military and rebels along its border with Thailand. How is that going?
Well, we don't have a lot of people in there right now, but it's certainly one of the issues of the human rights violations that was mentioned before. The other issue is whether the Burmese are negotiating with North Koreans for prohibited radiological weapons or technology. So it is a very complicated, multi-layer issue. And while everyone applauds Senator Webb for getting in and freeing this American, I still don't think we have a clear policy way ahead.
Is it clear to all of you that this was, in fact, sanctioned behind the scenes by the Obama administration and not Senator Webb just choosing to go forward himself, Nancy?
Well, the State Department said that they briefed Senator Webb before he took his trip. And I think, as Brian mentioned, the official line is that he was going as an individual, not as a representative of the administration, but still getting briefings behind the scenes. It's this sort of unorthodox form of diplomacy where they walk a fine line between getting American in without putting the Obama administration's stamp on it. So he certainly wasn't going on a whim on his own, and he didn't catch the Obama administration by surprise, that's for sure.
And in fact, some of the human rights groups criticized the mission. They were more than happy that the American was freed. But again, he was an American. He swam across a lake, spent 2 days there. But nothing really changed in the status of this rather iconic human rights advocate who remains under house arrest.
Right. And the threat is that the junta will now exploit this visit and say that the United States is somehow sanctioning our treatment of human rights of prisoners in our country.
Aung San Suu Kyi has been in home confinement for 14 of the past 20 years. I'm Susan Page, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. We're taking your calls, 1-800-433-8850. Let's go to Fairfax, Virginia, and talk to Alex. Alex, hi.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. I'm not sure that compassion was the only thing involved in freeing the terrorists in Scotland. The British jurisprudence has had many instances where they've been very tough, like with the Irish IRA people that had hunger strikes. I think that money might have had a lot to do with it, the fact that Gaddafi made a big payment because of Lockerbie just recently. And I think that money is, without that payment, there's no way this guy goes free.
Okay, Alex, thanks for your call. Now, what about this payment?
I mean, I've read some speculation that this might have something to do with the British oil company seeking to make inroads into Libya, but that sounds pretty cynical to me. I mean, we're talking about the Scottish judicial system here. We're not talking about some developing country regime.
Tom, what do you think?
Well, I mean, obviously these reports are out there, and those who are very critical with justification of the decision cite them. The difference with the hunger strike cases is a hunger strike is a conscious effort to make a political statement. This man, I'm sure, did not choose to get cancer.
Let's talk to Samina. She's calling us from Dallas, Texas. Hi, Samina.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. Just wanted to make a comment on something that is repeated ad nauseum on most of your programs about the region. And most of your guests and hosts do that, about how calmly punting the blame of everything on Pakistan. I just wanted to put your listeners and readers in perspective by reminding them that none of the September 11 hijackers or people behind it, none of those people were from Pakistan. And for some reason, Pakistan, and this is the second time in my lifetime, so we get dragged into America's problems and then very nicely and very calmly take all the blame lying down. And I'll take my answer. Well,
Samina, before you go, you're from Pakistan yourself?
I am, yes.
And you said this was the second time this has happened. What was the first time?
Well, the first time when the Soviet Union attacked Afghanistan, we were the ones who got dragged into the entire mess. I spent my lifetime there. I spent my teenage years growing up with the aftermath the teenager in my 20s with the aftermath of that Afghan war. And we had not recovered from that after America abandoned us with clutching all the millions of refugees, which we never get credit for, and moved away. And then, lo and behold, comes September 11, and then everything is Pakistan's fault. I mean, that is absolutely amazing.
All right, Samina, thanks so much for giving us your perspective. Any comments from our panel?
Well, I'll agree, and I'll also offer a contradiction. You are absolutely right that Pakistan is being sort of labeled this way, except for the 9/11 attacks. No one has ever said that Pakistan was responsible there. But I will go one further and agree with you that the U.S. policy was incredibly blind to abandon Pakistan and Afghanistan after the Soviets were finally ousted from the region. And then to add insult to injury, things like the Pressler Amendment, you know, kept our militaries from cooperating in ways that could have prevented the problems today. So absolutely, the caller is making a very strong case.
I would just add, one of the things we haven't talked about is the relationship and the tensions between Pakistan and India and how much that is all contributing to the problems that we're seeing in the region now.
Nancy Youssef from the McClatchy newspapers, Tom Shanker from the New York Times, and Brian Winter from USA Today. Thanks so much for joining us here in the International Hour of the Friday News Roundup.
Thank you.
I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. We all hope for a quick recovery. Thanks for listening.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, and Denise Couture. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dory Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR, National Public Radio.